yesterday was the sort of, as far as I'm concerned, like the big explanation about the book and where the idea came from. Although I'm happy to take questions about anything. It says in the program that this is a reading, so that's the way I'm thinking of it. I've got a different section to read from the one I did yesterday, and I thought, just because Greenbelt likes these kind of things, as an exclusive, I thought I could read something from the next book, which I only sent to the publishers a week ago, so it hasn't actually been approved, so it might be that it doesn't make it into the final book, but if people were interested, if we finish in time, because I thought that might be of interest. So thank you very much, Steve, for coming. This is going to be largely a reading from Itch, which came out in March. The paperback comes out in October. Itch, some of you will have read the book. Some of you have got no idea what I'm talking about at all. So I'll just fill you in just a little. Itch is short for Itchingham Loft. That's his name. He lives in Cornwall. He's 14. He goes to the local academy school. He has an 11-year-old sister called Chloe. He has a much older brother called Gabriel. Most importantly, he has a 14-year-old cousin called Jacqueline, who's known as Jack, and they're at school together. Itch is an element hunter. He considers himself an element hunter. He's a collector of the periodic table, which we went in great detail yesterday. So he collects, you know, he collects iron and lead and hydrogen and oxygen and all those things. This is the thing that makes him most excited. However, in the course of this quest, he has come across some rocks which are behaving in a most unusual fashion. They are very hot. They are very heavy. It turns out that he has discovered rocks which have not been discovered before. He takes them to a scientist who analyzes them at the local mining school. There is a machine which is called an X-ray fluorescent spectrometer. It zaps X-rays at something and then it comes back with a bunch of other messages and it tells you precisely what it's made from. This scientist tells him that these rocks have never been seen before, and they fit on the periodic table at 126, which is right off the scale because there are only 118 known elements. So what Itch has is a rock which is performing dangerously. It is fiercely radioactive and is making him and his friends very sick. He also has rocks which are unbelievably valuable because not only can they do great good, because it's essentially a nuclear startup kit in a bag. If you have them, you're a nuclear power. So that makes him a target for criminals and for governments. Same thing sometimes. And terrorists are after him. Anyway, everybody is after him. He's the most sought-after boy in the world. As I explained yesterday, his arch nemesis is his science teacher, Dr. Nathaniel Flowerdew, who has gone rogue. He used to be an oil dealer in Nigeria. And he got up to no good and was responsible for a disastrous oil leak, which led to many deaths. His science teacher has gone slightly mad. And I'm going to read you a section where Itch and Jack have been kidnapped by Nathaniel Flowerdew and his henchman, who is called Kinch, I think. It's a long time since I read it. And they're about to be taken to London. So in the car will be Kinch and Flowerdew and Jack and Itch, who are in a bad state. They've been with these rocks for a long time, and they are fierce emitters of dangerous radioactivity, and their health is seriously starting to suffer. So what I'll do is I'll do this reading from the book, then we'll do some questions if you have any, and then I'll do a reading from the new book, and then we can go and order snacks together. So, Flowerdew had insisted that Kinch dump the Range Rover and find another car. They needed to use the motorways, but everyone would be looking out for the Range Rover, so a suitable alternative needed to be pressed into action. Kinch trawled the local village and finally chose a silver graphite Lexus RX450H, which had proved the easiest to spring. It also had the advantage of a silent hybrid engine, meaning that it was able to leave the quietest road in the quietest village, disturbing no one at all. Flowerdew sat in the front with the bag and his briefcase at his feet. Jack and Itch sat in the back, hands tied in front of them and black masking tape over their mouths. Kinch had advised against gags, given that they'd been sick, and Flowerdew had reluctantly agreed. The rucksack with its canister of xenon anesthetic just under the top flap lay at Itch's feet. I should say that Itch has a rucksack which is full of his element collection. And in a desperate search to find something which he thinks might help his escape, he's come across a canister of xenon gas, which can be used as an anesthetic. It's usually used in bulbs. If you've ever been to an IMAX cinema, the fierce light that comes out of an IMAX cinema projector bulb is because it's got xenon gas in it. But xenon is also an anesthetic, and that's what they're going to try and use to escape. Don't try that at home, should you come across a canister of xenon gas. It was a hot day and the air conditioning was already working hard. As they pulled onto the M5, Itch was counting the number of air vents and noting where they were pointing. He could see 6 at the front, and he and Jack had 2 pointing straight at them. The sat-nav was estimating 3 hours and 170 miles to Paddington, which suddenly didn't seem like very long or very far. Even if Itch could work out how to empty the xenon into the car, they couldn't do it when they were driving along at 98 miles an hour. The M5 became the M4, and the miles to their Paddington rendezvous counted down. Flowerdew seemed in an exultant mood, conducting furiously to the classical music on the radio. Under cover of the extraordinary volume of sound put out by the car's sound system, Jack and Itch were able to conduct brief, unnoticed conversations. "We've only got about 90 minutes left, Itch. Come on, last chance." "I know, I'm still thinking." 30 minutes later. "Him being in such a good mood means trouble for us, doesn't it?" "Yeah, I reckon so." And then 40 miles out from the capital. "How are you feeling?" "I feel terrible. Rubbish, like I'm going to be sick again." They looked at each other and very slowly smiled. A proper ear-to-ear smile. They had both thought of the same thing at the same time. They turned away, looking out of the window in case Kinch or Flowerdew glanced in the mirror. As the end of the motorway approached, the traffic slowed and Flowerdew's mood changed. He became tense and switched off the radio. The final few miles of motorway passed in silence. As they joined the steamy queues of West London, the sat-nav said 4 miles to destination. The tailbacks around the Hammersmith roundabout moved inch by inch towards one set of traffic lights and then another. As the Lexus slowed again, Jack started groaning. "Shut up," said Flowerdew. "We're nearly there. Don't start now." Itch leant forward, teeth gritted. "It's called radiation poisoning," he snapped. "It's not something you can stop and start. You get dizzy, nauseous, then you're sick. Next is hair loss, fever, and maybe blood in your vomit. You're the brilliant scientist, Flowerdew. What would you suggest?" "I don't know, but from where I'm sitting, if she's sick like yesterday, it's going all over your head, Flowerdew. Whoever you're meeting to flog my rocks to, I'm sure they'd love you with puke in your hair." I did mention yesterday there's lots of vomit in the book, so. Flowerdew spun round and glared at them. Anger flashed in his eyes, but he knew Itch was right. "Damn. All right, pull in, Kinch. There's a place just there. Let's get this over and done with." They pulled off the road, leaving the slow-moving traffic to wend its way towards Shepherd's Bush. They were in a small cul-de-sac with parking for a dozen cars, and Kinch pulled into the first space he came to. Flowerdew produced a pocket knife, and reaching behind, roughly cut the tape that bound Itch and Jack's hands. He nicked the skin on Itch's left wrist with the point of the blade. "Oops," he sneered. Itch ignored the cut, undid his seatbelt, and leant over to undo Jack's. "Make it quick. We have an appointment in Paddington, all of us. So stay where we can see you," said Flowerdew, reaching for his phone. Itch opened his door and jumped out. He dropped his rucksack on the road and felt for the xenon canister. For a moment he thought he'd lost it, but his hands closed around the warm metal casing under the flap of the rucksack. He quickly went round to help Jack out of the other side of the car. As she sat on the pavement, her head between her knees, Itch went back to open the door on the other side of the car and looked at the hinge. It was surprisingly small, a flat metal connector which ran from the door to the body of the Lexus. The canister would sit quite happily on top. He glanced up. Inch was watching Jack, Jack was retching, and Flowerdew was on the phone. Now was the moment. He balanced the canister on the hinge, and with his heart thundering and his head pounding, he slammed the Lexus door shut with every ounce of strength that he had. There was a sharp metallic screech and then a crunch as the heavy-duty door made contact with the xenon. It bounced open again. The canister was bent, twisted, and dented. but not punctured. The xenon was still inside. Flowerdew and Kinch spun round. What the... Sorry, called Itch. Got the seatbelt stuck in the door. He held up the metal buckle and put on a silly me face. They appeared to accept this and turned back. Itch adjusted the canister slightly so that the weakest looking part of the casing would take the full force of the steel door. He slammed it again. He felt the door close a little further, but it still didn't shut. As he opened it once more, the canister fell onto the car floor and rolled slowly under Kinch's seat. Itch watched it as the mangled metal rotated twice and then stopped. At its base, where the unreadable Russian words were, was a small but clearly defined gash. Shutting the door quickly, it clicked this time. Itch ran round the front of the car and knelt in front of Jack. I think I did it. I slammed the door on it, and I think it's been punctured, but I can't be sure. And I used all of it, in case you're wondering. Jack snorted and coughed. Was there gas coming out when you shut the door? She asked from between her knees. It's colourless and odourless, Jack. I was hoping for a hiss or something, but I couldn't hear anything. We'll find out sooner or later. How long does it take to work? Don't know, but keep this up anyway. If it's going to work, it'll be in the next few minutes. How many is a few? Itch put his hand on Jack's shoulder and looked up at Flowerdew, who was still jabbering into his phone. Catching Itch's eye, he was waving them back into the car when Jack really was sick. Flowerdew watched and then resumed his conversation. Itch offered her the bottle of water he'd been given at breakfast and some tissues, then moved round to sit next to her on the curb. She took both and leant against him, her eyes closed. Itch looked at Kinch and Flowerdew and sat up, nudging Jack. He was laughing. It's worked, Jack. Look, they're absolutely out of it. He helped Jack to her feet, and they both stood staring at the occupants of the car. The driver and passenger looked as if they'd just parked up for a nap. Kinch's head was wedged up against the driver's side window, his mouth wide open. Flowerdew had slumped back, his head lolling uncomfortably towards Kinch. The xenon had emptied itself into the car, and, distributed by the powerful aircon system, had been inhaled by Kinch and Flowerdew in sufficient quantities to render them unconscious in 2 minutes. The cousins stood transfixed by what they had done. For a few seconds they took it in turns to stand in front of the car and call Flowerdew every bad word they had ever heard. But feeling they might be attracting attention, Jack pulled at Itch's shirt. Come on, get the rocks. We don't know how long they're going to stay like that. We have to open the door to get the box. Let's go. Itch held her back. No, wait. Let the xenon do its work. They'll be going deeper, I think. In a few minutes we could operate on them and they wouldn't wake up. Now that's tempting, said Jack, as they stood shakily and counted out 2 minutes. Okay, let's get the rocks, said Itch, not able to wait any longer. This needs to be quick. Hold your breath. He opened the front passenger door and pulled out the lead-lined toolbox, still in the canvas bag, out from under Flowerdew's feet. Next to it, he spotted the briefcase and took that too. Then he leant across and removed the key from the ignition, shut the door and then locked the car. Itch threw the key into the bush. Sweet, said Jack. Can we go? Give me the rucksack. Itch chucked it to her and she shouldered it. He picked up the canvas bag and its familiar weight cut into his hands. Can you take this too? He asked, holding Flowerdew's briefcase over. That's stealing, Itchingham laughed. We'll give it back, he said, grinning. Let's go. So they escape and they just have a slight problem of 8 unbelievably radioactive rocks to get rid of, which they may or may not do. And, yes, with a lot of radiation poisoning and a bit more vomit to come. So that's sort of just a little bit from Itch, just describing a little bit of the escape from Flowerdew, who's a really nasty piece of work, by the way. I don't know if there are any science teachers in today. There weren't any yesterday, so we could be as rude about them as possible. Any science teachers? Okay, well, some of them are nice, and pillars of respectability. And others are vile and evil. And that's the one that we've got in Flowerdew. So we have a shorter session here. So why don't we do some questions, if there are any questions. And if there aren't, then I can do some reading from the next book. And if you shout and make your question as loud as possible, then everyone can hear. But you don't need to shout because we have a microphone. There's a lady just in front here. This girl here? Yes.
I was in the session yesterday.
Thank you.
And you showed the trailer that the publisher has made for the book, and it seemed a lot darker than most of what you had said and read from about and from the book.
Yes.
So
why is that?
Yeah.
Well, the bit that I read from the book yesterday was, I mean, it's difficult to pick a package to pick a passage to read to a crowd who haven't read all the setup and all the characters. So I chose a book a bit yesterday when they're at school and everyone's getting sick from the arsenic poisoning. The bit in the trailer concerns a death, and there is death in the book as well. So they picked on that as a moment, a particularly dramatic moment. So the publishers, in trying to find a bit that would work in the trailer, chose that because it was more dramatic. And I think that's why they chose it. And there is some dark stuff in the book, and there is some funny stuff in the book. So, but it's a good observation. Very good. You'll be a literary critic when you're a little bit older, is my guess. Yes, over there. Are you the daughter of the science teacher? Okay. Don't look embarrassed. It's a cool thing. She's not evil. Most of the time.
I think she is.
Fair enough. Don't think you're eating tonight. Or if you are, I'd check your food. Yes.
It's birthday cake.
All right, okay, it's birthday cake. Fine. Was there a question that you had?
Where did he even find the rocks?
Where does he find the rocks? Well, yes, read the book is one answer. Well, what happens is he has a friend called Cake, who's a man who is an element dealer who sells this stuff. And he gets his rock from Cake. He's traded it. Cake hasn't realized what it is, and so Itch ends up with it. As to how he gets the other seven, you'll have to... have to investigate further. But Cake is involved with that as well. So that's where they come from. And if you want to know where Cake got them from, you'll have to... it's a little bit of an explanation involved with that, but the clue is on the first page of the book. If you need that. Yes, any other questions? At the back. How long is the session, by the way? Does anyone know? How long have we gone?
About 45 minutes.
Okay. Yes.
What inspired you to write the book?
Well, there was a whole bunch of things inspired me to write the book, because I've interviewed lots of authors over many years, and they all say, I've always wanted to write a book. And I have never wanted to write a book. So it was never my intention to write a book at all. But my son got very interested in science, and through the show I was doing at Five Live, I started to get increasingly interested in science as well. And the key bits of it, as I said in the chat yesterday, were discovering that the word element hunter described someone who collected the periodic table. And I thought element hunter was such a cool phrase for a slightly odd hobby that I thought, well, kids like collecting things, let's write a story about an element hunter. But I was so sure that someone else would have done it before me that I did a mad, crazy search for Element Hunter, and there is a Japanese cartoon series that's similar, but there's been nothing written like this as far as I can make out, unless someone's going to say, I wrote this 5 years ago and you stole my idea. So it was that, and then also reading about this kid called David Hahn, the radioactive Boy Scout, who, in the 90s in America, at the age of 14, essentially built a nuclear breeder reactor in his parents' shed. And the authorities found out about it just in time and shut it down, but he did do that. And so I put all that stuff together, and I just started to think of this story. And Itchingham Loft was a real person in the 17th century, as was Nathaniel Plowdew. And I just nicked their names. So it was all those ideas coming together, and it ended up... It was just going to be a short story from about 4 pages, and it ended up slightly longer. It's a good question, though. Yes, anyone else got a question? Down here.
Another girl.
Hi.
Have you got any tips for writing stories?
Well, you see, now it's a very good question, and I have been asked that question. Obviously, if you write a book, people are gonna ask that. I'm a radio presenter. That's what I do most of the time. And I've written this book, and I've enjoyed writing it very much, and I've written a second book. The reason I'm saying that is that I still feel a bit ill-equipped to answer the question, because I've only done it the once, and then hopefully people will like the second one. The only advice that really makes any sense is to read as much as you possibly can. A real broad variety of stuff, some stuff that you like and authors that you like a lot, and then some authors that you're not sure that you've heard of before. Because the more goes in, you know, then eventually when you come to write a story, there's more for the brain to process, and this is probably very bad science, but I just think that the more that you've got coming in, the more chance you've got of having something interesting coming out again. So read as widely and as much as you possibly can, and write, and don't think that you have to write and show it to people. Write for your own benefit. Write stuff that you want to write because you think it's good. After about the first chapter, I wrote something that I liked. So although I started writing it for my son, in the end, I was just writing it because I was enjoying writing it. So, and I think people are scared of writing it and then showing it to people in case someone says, this is really rubbish and boring. Write for yourself. Write stuff that you like. And then when you've got it into a reasonable shape, then maybe show it to someone else. But maybe not. Maybe just keep it in a whole bunch of stories which are just yours. And you'll realize that story is quite good and that story is not quite so good, and maybe you'll be a world-class writer that sells millions and millions of books. Is that what you'd like to do, do you think? Yeah? Do you write stories now? Yeah? Can you just give her that? Can you give her that mic? So how old are you? What's your name, by the way?
Ellen.
Okay, would you like to be a writer, Ellen, do you think?
Definitely. Okay.
Who's your favourite writer?
I'm not really Suzanne Collins.
Okay, so we're talking Hunger Games, yeah? Which is just fantastic series of books. I mean, truly wonderful and very dark and nasty, and while still having interesting things to say. And so that's great. So I hadn't read any Suzanne Collins before The Hunger Games. So she hit on a fantastic idea. But she won't just have written that at your age. You know, she would have written and worked out ideas and had some stuff which was rubbish, and then had some stuff that was, you know, getting better. And I would say, because the thing that works for me is, when I have got something that I need to write, is to write something every day, even if it's a paragraph. Even if it's not a very good paragraph, just to get into the habit of writing something and doing it on a regular basis, which is something I've had to learn. But that's the thing that works for me. So maybe some of that will work for you. Hey, I hope it works.
Thank you.
Anyone else got some questions? There's a question at the back from someone who's over 14.
Over 14.
So let's take that question.
Could you pass the mic back?
And then we'll come back down to the front.
Hi. That's loud. I was just wondering which was easier for you, writing the story or getting the science right, given it's a book about science.
Yeah. I think getting... yes, that's... I mean, both, which is a cheating answer, but I think getting the story was more difficult and took longer, because the thing that will... If the book works, it works because it's an adventure story. It's not a science book. I am not a scientist, but it's a book about a kid who likes science, and there's quite a big difference, I think. So getting the plot right and making an exciting story, I think, is the most difficult thing, because... Once I'd worked out what I wanted the science to do, I could then ask scientists. So I could then find out. So when I found out that in that passage that I read out, it took me a while to find out that xenon was an anesthetic. Indeed, most of the chemists that I spoke to had never heard of the fact that xenon was an anesthetic. But then when I spoke to an anesthetist at a local hospital, he said, yes, no, you're absolutely right. You know, that, you know, this could work. You would never use it as an anesthetic because it's too expensive. But yes, this would, you know, this essentially would work. But it was very important that the science works, because it's set in the real world and itch doesn't have any magic powers. So the real science had to be, you know, proper and authentic. So the fact that he's discovered a new element, which is off the chart at 126, is of course fantastical, but scientists will say, yes, this is possible. And it exists within something which is called the island of stability. And I'm getting a little bit technical here, but at the top end of the periodic table, as all scientists will know, all the elements start to get very, very radioactive, and they only exist for fractions of a second and only exist in labs. We have to make them. But some scientists believe that when we go beyond 118 and into the 120s, that these elements that we're talking about may well exist for longer, maybe for days, weeks, years, hundreds, thousands of years. And that 126 is right where the island of stability would be. So we're talking about mythical rocks, which could be created from a supernova, and that's how, you know. So all this is within the believability stakes of real science. So I haven't made any of it up, is what I'm saying. And I did get some senior professors to sign it off at the end. But that, in a way, that's easier because it either works or it doesn't. Getting a story that is exciting for 11, 12, 13-year-olds, that's more of a challenge. So I hope that answers the question. But, you know, both were equally important. Yes, we've got a question. Question here down at the front. Yes, sir.
Are you still going to do Itch Goes to the Zoo?
All right. Now, yesterday when we were doing a session, I was saying about how the second book is done and is called Itch Rocks, and I shall read a bit of that in a moment. And then someone asked whether I was going to do any more, and this hasn't been decided yet, but the consensus of opinion seemed to be that it should be called Itch Goes to the Zoo. And there was a girl in the audience who just wanted to know if Itch had any pets, and I didn't think it was very wise because the pets would probably end up getting blown up or burnt or choked with poison gas. Anyway, so we then built a story about Itch Goes to the Zoo where, if I remember right, Itch is thrown into a pit of red ants and is saved by an elephant's trunk, but Itch then feeds sodium to the elephant, and the elephant swallows it and blows up because reacting with the gastric juices in his stomach. This doesn't, to me, sound like a winning storyline for my third book. So what I'm tempted to do is to actually write a story for Greenbelt, Itch Goes to the Zoo, and maybe do it next year. I don't think it'll get published, but why don't next year we reconvene and have a story called Itch Goes to the Zoo, and it'll involve an exploding elephant. Yay! All right. So I really shouldn't have said that now, because now I'm going to have to do it. Okay, I'm booked. Okay, we've got a question down here at the front. Yes.
How do you feel about writing books?
How do I feel about writing books? Well, I've only done two, and I've had an absolute ball. I've had a fantastic time. It's really, really strange because it's a very lonely thing, because it's just you. And I didn't ask anyone their opinion until it was finished. I didn't ask about the characters, whether anyone liked the characters or whether anyone liked the story, if anyone found all the vomit off-putting. I just wrote the whole thing and then handed it over and said, there you go, what do you think? So there are moments where I'm desperate to say, what do you think? Does this bit work? But I was convinced that actually that would not be a good idea. So I wrote the whole thing on my own, and then I asked for opinions after that. So it's a completely different thing, but I had a fantastic time. And if you get a chance, if you have an idea one day, you go for it. It's great fun. Right, anyone else got a question? This girl's got another question. We'll come back to you, but you have asked a question. So why don't we have the gentleman in orange at the back, which probably was originally white.
It's got mud flavours.
Yes, sir.
Hi. I was just wondering if the storyline changed as you wrote the book, or if you had the whole story planned.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Or whether it changed as you went
through. So I don't know if you could hear that. He's wondering if the storyline changed at all through the book. I got some... After I'd written about 10,000 words, I realised that I wasn't really sure what I was doing. So I had... there's a writer called Charlie Fletcher who's written books for kids in the past, and we had him on the program, and he's very friendly, and I sent him an email, and he said to me, do you know how the book's going to finish? And I said, well, roughly, I know roughly how it's going to finish. And he said, work out exactly how it's going to finish, nail it down, and then you can enjoy any meander that you might take as you're writing it. But if you don't nail it down, you'll find that you've meandered so far off course that you're not writing the same book. So I knew how it was going to finish, but an awful lot of it just appeared as I went through it. So the bit which I've just read where they were kidnapped or how they escaped from that, I didn't know that they were going to be kidnapped when I started the book. It just seemed that it had to happen. There's a section at the end where Itch is dealing with the rocks, and I didn't realise quite what he was going to have to do until he actually gets to the final place. So a lot of it comes out of the logic of writing the story. So I had a rough outline of some of the ideas. I knew a definite ending, and then the rest of it sort of emerged as I went through it. Yes, the boy in blue.
Would you like to make a series of Itch?
You mean a series of books or...
A series of books.
Yeah, well, I... Yeah, when I, the older people in this crowd, some of them might remember a series of books by Willard Price. Yeah, Paul Cookson does. They were adventure books for boys. They were called Underwater Adventure. They were called Amazon Adventure. They were Underwater Adventure. Everything was a something adventure. It was about two boys who went around the world collecting animals for their dad's zoo. And in the last paragraph, you got a hint about what the next book was going to be. And in fact, they've just been reissued by Random House. And I think I had that in the back of my mind because the periodic table is 118 elements. And part of me thought, I wonder if there's one element which would lead itself to a story. And I don't think that's going to happen. But I think there are a number of stories waiting to be written. We'll just see if people like the second one. Because if people like the second and third, then there's a fourth. And I've got 118 elements to work my way through. So let's reconvene in 20 years, 30 years, and we'll write another story together. Any other questions? Yes, gentleman in a hat there. Looks as though he's in Mumford & Sons. It's a very fine look, sir. What's your question?
Are you just going to stick with the character Itch, or are you going to adventure into other characters as well?
Well, I'm very gratified to have lots of girls in the audience because I made a particular point of... Because Itch is a boy, and it can be a bit geeky at times, this world, of writing two very strong girls in there because Jack is a... I like as much as Itch, and Chloe is like a Lisa Simpson character to Bart, and is sort of, the girls are far more streetwise than Itch is, and they kind of survive and exist as a team, and I like writing about the three of them, and so I think I'll stay with the three of them, and in the second book I'm not going to say. So essentially the answer is I'm going to stick with Itch, but Jack and Chloe are still going to be part of the story because I think just writing about a boy hero is a bit boring. But if you've got the girls in there and they're both really strong girls, hopefully that'll keep the balance about right. So, any other questions before we move on? There's a gentleman or a lady in a hoodie. It's a chap. Okay, phew. Yes.
So, do you prefer writing or being on the radio?
Well, being on the radio is my job. That's what I have to do. That's what I enjoy doing. And I kind of know instinctively what I'm doing there. And if I had to choose now, I'd have to say, being on the radio is what I'm going to do for the next 10, 15, 20 years. But the writing thing has been such a blast. I hope I can carry on writing for as long as people... by the books, and because being on the radio playing records is a part-time job, really, it means that I can write in the morning and then do my part-time job in the afternoon. Okay, anyone else got some questions? Gentleman down at the bottom in the Beatles t-shirt. And then we'll come back to you. Yes, sir.
Does Mr. Kermode think that the book should be made into a film?
Well... Mr. Kermode has read the book to his son and has grudgingly sent congratulations because he enjoyed it. It would be a fairly terrifying prospect if it ever did become a film and it came up for review. I think I'd probably have to absent myself from the room because, who knows. And he would absolutely, if it wasn't good, he'd absolutely say, this is the biggest pile of pants, since... Sex in the City 2, it will be a nice problem to have, and if he flags it off, then at least it's been made. He liked it and was very supportive and didn't work, and most gratifyingly didn't spot the twists and the surprises in there, so thank you for that. This girl down there, do you still have a question? Yes, okay, she had another question.
Where is it available?
Where is it available? Well, I have to confess, I came to Greenbelt without a copy of my own book. So I borrowed... Well, actually, I was talking to Murray Watts next door and convinced him to buy a book so I could borrow his, because I thought being seen to go and buy my own book would look rather desperate. So Otherwise, I'd have to borrow someone else. Anyway, so it's available next door, and at all. But thank you for asking. And online, and in most shops. Who else has got a question? Yes, lady with sunglasses on her head.
So, what did your science-loving son make of it?
It was great.
Don't spoil it. Okay, is that enough of a review for you? Well, what was interesting, when I wrote it, I didn't tell anyone what I was... I mean, they knew I was writing, but they didn't know what I was writing or who it was for. So when I printed it off, 400 pages from the printer, I gave it to Joe and I said, there you go, that's go and read that, because it's for you. So he then disappeared and pronounced it that he liked it, so which was a big relief, as it had a target audience of one. And if he'd come back and said, you know what, that was really dull. And kids can't, you know if they're just saying it, you know, they're going, well, you know, I thought, yeah, they were quite good bits. You know that they're just trying to please you. But no, he did like it. And he's read the second one as well. He likes that as well. Anyone else got a question? Any more questions? Gentleman in shirt. In the middle at the back there. Over there. Turn left, straight ahead. Yes, sir.
I notice you're wearing an Exorcist t-shirt. Did Mark Kermode make you wear that? And
no.
Secondly, what's it like working with the Good Doctor?
this t-shirt was bought for me by my wife as a joke for when I was doing an outside broadcast with Mark last Christmas. And I've never seen The Exorcist, but I just thought it would annoy him further. And working with Mark is great. It's a fairly extraordinary radio program. We have clearly defined roles. He watches the films, I play the records, and he takes the mickey out of me and I take the mickey out of him. And he's the best at what he does. So all I have to do is to provoke him and watch it all happen from there. And he's been off, he takes like 20 weeks holiday or something like that a year. So I've been struggling without him, but he'll be back on Friday and battle will recommence on Friday. No, but it's great fun. And he is the best at what he does. So you can quote that back to him, any tweeters here. There's a question from a very glamorous woman with the sunglasses. Just behind you, as the audience gets further back. Do come forward. It's not working.
Is it on now?
Yes.
Okay. Itch's dad is quite an elusive character in the book. Does he feature more in the second one? And, some of the thing you want to talk about with him?
Itch's parents... Itch is unusually, as some people have pointed out, for a kid's book, he's not an orphan. He actually has parents and uses public transport, which is one I hadn't realised was unusual as well. Yes, Itchy's father is called Nicholas. As I mentioned this yesterday, the real Itchingham Loft was a priest in Suffolk in the 17th century. And his father was called Nicholas, and so I made Itchy's father called Nicholas as well. So his parents are called Nicholas and Jude. And he is quite an elusive figure. Yes, he works on an oil rig, and he's not there a lot of the time. So he has this kind of remote father with a remote father son relationship, which is one of the reasons why he's friendly with Cake. The answer to your question is he has a... yes, there's lots of him in the second book. We do find out more about the family in general. And I have already... For those of you who do listen to the movie show, if it ever does get cast, the father is to be played by David Morrissey. And David was very keen that his role is not any smaller than it is in this book. So I've reassured him that he has a much larger role in this. The role of Flower Dew is to be played by played by Michael Sheen. Jason Isaacs plays the role of Colonel Fairney, who comes up towards the end of the book, who also has a bigger role in the second book. And for veteran Greenbelters, the role of Fairney in the book is quite deliberate. And if anyone remembers Bev and Steve Fairney, well, Bev is still with us, thank God. And Steve was an extraordinary, larger-than-life guy who died many years ago, but I wanted his name to live on. So Colonel Fanny in the book is an homage to Steve Fanny. But to answer your question, yes, he is quite elusive, and yes, you do find out a lot more in the second book. Thank you. Thank you for reading it. Is that with you with a question, or were you just... Hey? He's just waving to his son. Okay, all right, and let's all wave back. Okay, anyone else got a question? There's a question over there, and then we'll do a green belt. So there's some question, all questions around here. And then we'll read to you from Itch Rocks. Just over here. Elusive boy in the corner. Yes, sir.
How did you come up with the name Cake for the guy called Cake?
All right, okay. Is the person who prompted me yesterday here? You're there, okay. What was it? Yeah, Yellow Cake Uranium is the answer. Thank you. I'm gonna have to watch you. When I was writing it, the Yellow Cake Uranium was being discussed. It did have, if I remember this right, British intelligence gave information about Yellow Cake Uranium to the American authorities when in the build-up to the Iraq War, and it was used as evidence to suggest that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and it turned out that he didn't have Yellow Cake Uranium. But I was looking for a strange name for a strange guy, and that's where it came from. So, and there's more about that in the second book as well, but it comes from Yellow Cake Uranium. Thank you. Another question here, yeah.
And do you have a favourite element now?
Do I have a favourite element?
Gold. Gold and platinum and silver.
I think Mercury is fascinating because it is quite so extraordinary. I think it's really odd to have a favourite element, really. So I don't think normal people have favourite elements. But if you had to have a big lump, I'm not saying it's an odd question, it's a very good question, because I've been asked it many times before and I've always struggled to think of what my favourite element is. But I think, you know, if you had to have a big lump of something, gold is a pretty good place to be. And it is the only element, and I'm sure our science teacher will correct me if I'm wrong. If you had a big lump of anything and you put it in the ground and you left it till next greenbelt, when you dug it out, it would look a mess. Gold will not look. It's the only element which doesn't tarnish, and it will look as perfect and brilliant, well, once you've hosed the mud off, as anything. And it is unique and it is extraordinary. So let's go for gold. Pardon? We need a microphone here for the professor. Doubtless is going to give me a critique of my answer on gold. I said I'm not a scientist, I'm a DJ.
It should be oxygen because you will need it.
Fair enough, I entirely agree with that. So, anyone else with a question? Yes, and then we'll do a reading from the new book. Yeah.
Going back to favourite things, who's your favourite character in the book and why did you enjoy writing about them?
In this book?
Yeah.
Well, it would be cheating, I suppose, to say Itch, because, I mean, obviously Itch is my favourite character because the whole book hangs on him and hangs on what he can do and hangs on his obsession with the elements that he's dealing with. So it won't work without him. But as I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, I really, really like Jack. They work together. You know, Itch doesn't have a lot of mates. Jack is the first person who kind of sees that there's something special about him. And as cousins, they go off on this adventure. And she's really sparky, and she's really clever, and she's really smart. And I think, I mean, if it's not Itch, it's going to be Jack, I would say. Anyone I least like? Well, I mean, I suppose I created them. So, I mean, there are some pretty odious people in here. And you'd have to say that Flower Dew is pretty obnoxious. He has some obnoxious people around him, and we're going to get onto another one of those in just a moment. So I would say it's pretty hard to beat someone who's caused an oil leak in Nigeria, which has led to the deaths of many people. He let his best friend go to jail because of that. a woman called Shivi Tan Phuc, and who we find out a lot more about in the second book, and then kidnaps a boy and his friend and tries to kill them with radiation. So that's pretty bad, you know. So I would say that's bad as it gets. Anyone else with a question? Yes, just there, and then we'll do a reading. Behind you, just there.
So does element hunting become a family business then?
Well, after Joe read the book, he did start to collect the periodic table. So Pardon? You got 11. Okay, it's quite easy to start a collection of the elements, as I mentioned yesterday, because you've got stuff lying around the house. Cutlery is covered in chromium. Shells have got calcium in. The saucepans have got fluorine in. So you can get a collection quite easily. You just have to ask permission before you take your mum's earrings, which are covered in titanium. You know, you do have to ask about that. So will it be a family business? Well, I don't know. It could be. I mean, it's quite a fun thing to collect, you know. And as long as you don't do anything like collect radioactive material, which is not a good idea, then maybe, who can say? You look as though you've got another question there.
But also as in, because Itch, Chloe and Jack are all one family.
Oh, I see. You mean their family. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. No, not at all. Chloe and Jack still remain baffled, frankly, by Itch's obsession, and they're the kind of the balance to him. So it's just going to be him, I think, who carries on. So what I read a bit from the new book, which, as I mentioned, hasn't come out yet, indeed hasn't been approved or edited. So if you hear any spelling mistakes, they're mine. If there's any bad grammar, that is definitely mine. Right at the end of the first book, there is the first little bit of the second book, which is the escape from prison of Shivi Tan Phuc, who I just mentioned, who was Flowerjee's mate in Nigeria. Between them, they were responsible for the oil leak. So at the end of the book, Flowerjee has escaped and is he's escaped, but has been caught by Greencore, who's the company who employ him. Shivi has escaped from prison, and this is the section in the book where Shivi tries to find Flowerjee. It takes place on an oil rig called the Ocean Bar oil rig in the Falkland Islands, South Atlantic. It's August. Okay? This is a Greenbelt exclusive. It might even be rubbish. You never know. With temperatures set at freezing, the winds running at 40 knots, and sleet and snow swirling around the helipad, a group of oil workers hurried to the galley. They were exhausted and hungry after a grueling 6-hour shift and needed hot food and drink fast. They crashed through the doors and the warmth and smells of the kitchen overwhelmed them. Comma. As they stood around cheerfully shedding their many layers of waterproofing, they noticed an unusual sight at the far table. The galley chef, an enormous red-faced American by the name of George Sanders, had one of his colleagues face down in a pizza. Sanders' chef's apron and overalls strained to enclose his bulk as he twisted the tomato and cheese smeared face left and right on the table. "You all right, George?" called one of the men. "Hell yeah! Just meeting out some chef's justice." Saunders smiled at the new arrivals. "Some folk just seem to forget who's in charge here. They seem to think that they can tell me what to do. Imagine that. I'm just reminding my assistant here that this is unwise." He's American. 3 other galley hands were watching from the serving counter, laughing and clapping. The chef held the man's curly white hair with one hand while the other wiped what was left of the pizza over his face like a flannel. "Who's in charge here, Blossom, huh? Bud, get it? Who's in charge?" Saunders laughed as the remains of the 12-inch margarita flopped onto the floor. "Yes, I get it," said a quiet voice, blowing tomato paste and shredded cheese from his mouth. The chef pulled him up and spun him round to face him. "Say sorry, chef." A moment's pause. "Sorry, chef." "What have you learned, bud?" "I have learned..." Excuse me. I can't shout in American. And compete with a choir. "I have learned," said the chef's assistant in a clipped, educated voice, "that clearly you are in charge and I am not." Too right, Flower Man, too right. Now you go and do some dishes. I know you can't go and clean yourself up first. You look just fine as it is. The oilman laughed as Dr. Nathaniel Flowerdew, fourth galley assistant, made his way behind the counter and disappeared into the kitchen. Flowerdew had arrived on the rig a month ago. The multinational oil company Greencore owned the Ocean Bar, and the rig had been chosen as a punishment. They had not taken kindly to their former employee losing the most valuable rocks of all time. The newly discovered element 126, fiercely radioactive and considered to be nuclear power in a bag, disappeared after he'd tried to sell them to a Nigerian politician. The Greencore bosses had toyed with sending him to their project in Baffin Bay, Greenland, but in the end had opted for the Falkland Islands for its utter remoteness. At the very southern tip of the South America, the rig was 30 miles out from the capital, Port Stanley, and the only airport for hundreds of miles. This was punishment, Greencore style. His prison was a 20-year-old, semi-submersible oil rig, which had been towed from its previous berth in the North Sea. It was surrounded by the stormy Atlantic waves and populated by 100 of the toughest oil men and women in the business. All they were told of their new arrival was that he was a thief, a crook, and not to be trusted. Life as a galley assistant was every bit as uncomfortable for Flowerdew as Greencore had intended it to be. He finished his shift of washing up saucepans and scrubbing down floors at midnight. The oil exploration and drilling was a 24-hour-day operation, so the catering had to be too. Excuse me. A new galley shift had arrived, and Flowerdew was first out of the doors. The roar of the wind and cold took his breath away, and he paused to zip his coat up to the chin. Pulling a black cap low over his eyes, he bustled past the enormous crew-carrying S-61 helicopter and hauled himself up to the steps to the living quarters. He wanted to get to the bar first, avoid the queue, and avoid the jokes. Large whiskey, please. No ice, no water. He knew the man behind the bar. He was part of the catering team, but he couldn't remember his name, so he just smiled and hoped he'd be served. The steward was in his 20s, had cropped hair and a ready smile. "It's Alessandro, remember? I showed you round when you arrived." "Oh, yes, of course," said Flowerdew, without conviction. "Drink, please." Alessandro pointed to the corner of the room. "Your friend has already bought you one." He nodded to a sofa where a small hunched figure was sitting with his back to him. "Friend? Unlikely," said Flowerdew, but he could see two whiskies on the table and walked over. He tried to see a face reflected in the glass which surrounded the small bar, but whoever it was had their face buried deep in a magazine. Flowerdew sat down in the chair opposite his guest and reached for his whisky. He didn't make it. "Hello, Nathaniel." Shivi Tan Fook lowered the magazine and stared at her old boss. Flowerdew froze. He was leaning forward, his hand centimetres from the glass, but his eyes were now wide with shock and fear. He was already pale, but all blood seemed now to have left his face completely. He sat back. "But you're in prison," he swallowed hard. "I got out. 25 years, I thought. 3 was enough." He stared blankly at the glass wall. Shivi sat forward. "Is that it? No apologies, no explanation?" She spoke fiercely, her face flushed. "That should have been you in prison. The Nigerian deep drill was your idea. The spill, your fault. The deaths of those workers are your fault. My 3 years in Ikoyi prison, your fault. The beatings I took, your fault. This here," she showed him a livid chunk of scar on the back of her neck. "A broken bottle from a point-blank range, your fault, you scumbag." Quite like that. There were other words, but they got removed. His tone was softer now. He even tried a small smile. "I argued with Revere and Vandenhauer, who are the guys who run the company. Honestly, I did. I told them that I told them as the guys that ran the company, they should help you too. But they said," and before he could finish his sentence, she was on him. He felt the point of a knife in his ribs and he gasped. He looked desperately at the bar, but there was no one there. "You are a liar and a crook, Flowerdew. You'd do anything, say anything to save your pathetic neck. This time it's not working." She pushed the knife a little harder. "I've thought about this moment every day for 3 years, you know, and it is every bit as good as I thought it would be." Flowerdew was sweating hard. "Please, Shibby, let's talk this through. I have money." "You have nothing. Really, you have nothing." She was speaking millimetres from his ear. "And when you fall overboard, no one will notice and no one will care." Just then, Alessandro the barman returned with 3 customers following him, and Shibby backed off. "Don't even think of calling for help," she hissed, as she settled on the arm of Flowerdew's chair. The knife disappeared back up her sleeve. "Can I tell you a story?" he said. "No, shut up. Just until they go away," he gestured at the drinkers. "Then you can push me overboard." "What sort of a story?" "The most incredible story you've ever heard, actually, about a boy and some precious stones." "How long will it take?" "Oh, not long," said Flowerdew. "Who's the boy?" "Ah, his name is Itchingham Loft." "Stupid name," said Shivy. "Yes, it is, isn't it?" said Flowerdew. He looked at the whiskey. Shivy nodded. He picked up the glass, and he sipped slowly. And that's the end of the exclusive. Thank you. So he's back in business.
Oh, no, it's terrible.
Anyway, and then the next chapter is where we are with Itch, who starts the book as the most protected boy in the world, but that's in another book for another day. Thank you very much, Dee, for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being attentive. Thank you for knowing the answer to the questions. It's been fantastic to be here again. Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for listening.